From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The S&P 500 hit an all-time high today as Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell testified before Congress. The NASDAQ and Dow Jones also spiked. Could it be that Powell hinted he may slash interest rates, something President Trump has been vocal about on Twitter and elsewhere? NPR Chief Economics Correspondent Scott Horsley is here. Scott, why do you think Wall Street's so happy?
Wall Street widely expects the Federal Reserve will cut interest rates when its rate-setting committee meets later this month. And in his testimony today, Chairman Powell did nothing to pour cold water on that theory. He basically reinforced the notion that a rate cut at the end of July is all but certain. We saw the stock futures market jump as soon as his prepared testimony was released about an hour before the market opened. Stocks sort of roared forward in the opening minutes after the opening bell. We've seen a little bit of backtracking since then, I think, as investors sort of said, well, this is really just telling us what we already knew. We already thought this rate cut was coming. But so the market's pretty happy, if not maybe quite as exuberant as they were first thing in the morning.
Well, the market and the president, would like rate cut slash because it means more money's available and it's cheaper and it's all sloshing around. But weren't there concerns that the economy could get too overheated?
There are a number of reasons for the Fed to be cautious in cutting rates. One is sort of substantive, which is you don't want to cut rates prematurely if the market's really doing if the economy's really doing fine. Remember, rates are already low, and so you in some ways you want to kind of keep your powder dry in case you need a real big rate cut in the future. The other has to do with perception. The Fed is fine cutting rates on its own as a response to economic forces. They don't want to appear to be kowtowing to the president because defending Fed independence is very important for the central bank's future credibility.
Well, in fact, Democrats and Republicans framed some of the hearing around that independence. Here's Committee Chair Maxine Waters questioning Powell directly about that.
Mr. Chairman, if you got a call from the president today or tomorrow, and he said, I'm firing you, pack up, it's time to go, what would you do?
Well, of course, I would not do that.
I can't hear you.
My answer would be no.
Scott, your sense of that?
Yes, the chairman was basically repeating something he said before, which is that he has a four-year term as chairman of the Federal Reserve, and he intends to serve it out. He can only be removed for cause, and he doesn't think he's given the president any cause to remove him.
Well, Powell's also asked about minimum wage, the president's trade wars, the economy. In the minute we have, just give us a sense of his sense of the economy.
Well, he thinks the economy is still growing, albeit at a slower pace than it was at the beginning of the year. He does think there are some headwinds coming, having to do with global slowdown, uncertainty about trade. He's concerned about the drop in business investment, even as consumer spending, which accounts for nearly three-quarters of the economy, remains pretty strong. So he's bullish, but not without some reservations. He did not weigh in on questions about, say, the minimum wage or trade policy, just as he doesn't want the executive or anybody else meddling in monetary policy, sees that as sort of the purview of the Fed. He leaves it to Congress to make decisions about things like the minimum wage. We had the CBO come out this week and say hiking the minimum wage could help a lot of people, but also might lead to some job cuts. Chairman Powell simply said, well, there would be trade-offs in that, but that's for Congress to decide. And whatever choice you make, we will just factor into our models.
NPR Chief Economic Correspondent Scott Horsley. Scott, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, we're going to take a few moments now to look at a piece of Ross Perot's legacy, third parties. The Texas billionaire died yesterday at 89, and he was one of the most successful third-party presidential candidates in American history. Perot ran against Democrat Bill Clinton and incumbent Republican President George H.W. Bush back in 1992.
I was not put on the ballot by either of the two parties. I was not put on the ballot by any PAC money, by any foreign lobbyist money, by any special interest money. This is a movement that came from the people. This is the way the framers of the Constitution intended our government to be, a government that comes from the people.
Perot speaking in the first debate in 1992, he ended up with 19% of the vote in that election, which was won by Clinton. By comparison, no third party or independent candidate got more than 3% of the vote in 2016. Joining us now is Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Hi, Julian.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's talk about Perot's run in 92. First of all, what made him so appealing to voters that he got 19% of the vote?
Well, I think there was an anti-incumbent mood that was still in the air, and he was able to capitalize on that and talk about deficits and debt to raise his stakes during a recession. But he also understood it was the year of cable television. It had come, and he uses it to his advantage. He announces his candidacy on Larry King Live on CNN. He has infomercials.
Yeah, he had a 30-minute ad, I remember, one night on TV.
Yeah, that looks like a show, and right. He sells his ideas, and he does them as if they're a TV show. So he really understood how the medium was offering new opportunities to speak directly to voters.
Now, he lost, but he did have a pretty big impact on the way we conduct our democracy, didn't he?
That's exactly right. Even though he doesn't create a new era of third-party politics, he does help lay the foundation for cable era politics and thinking of new formats to reach voters. So even when you see candidates and presidents use Twitter today, you can draw a line between that and the infomercials you were just talking about, where candidates just avoided all filters and spoke to voters themselves.
Do you think that Bill Clinton became president because of Ross Perot's candidacy?
It's unclear. Political scientists debate that. It looked like he would have won even if Perot was not in the race. But there is evidence that Perot didn't help, and he raised this issue of high deficits, which really haunted the Reagan and Bush administrations.
Okay, well, let's talk about another famous third-party candidate, and that would be Ralph Nader in 2000, who ran in the Green Party. Here he is speaking on CNN before the election.
It's often been said the only wasted vote is the vote for someone you don't believe in. Historically in our country, the great surges of justice have come from people voting their conscience, their hopes, their dreams. That's what I'm confident our supporters will do.
Now, everyone remembers what happened there. The election went to the Supreme Court. It was very close in the state of Florida. George W. Bush was the winner over Al Gore. But Nader got less than 3% of the vote. A lot of people still think that he is the reason the race turned out the way that it did.
Right. And Ralph Nader's given third-party candidates a bad name. And in states like Florida, which was decisive in 2000, that small number of voters who he was able to attract probably were taken away from Al Gore and could have very well cost Democrats the campaign. So that shows that when third-party candidates are not really going to win electoral college votes, what they are going to do in these swing states is take votes away from the party and could very well cost someone who you're sympathetic to generally the vote.
Going back even further, let's talk about the 1968 campaign. The Southern segregationist George Wallace ran for president as an independent that year. Here he is campaigning in California.
And if you go out of this building tonight and somebody knocks you in the head, the person who knocks you in the head is out of jail before you get to the hospital, and on Monday morning, they will try the policeman. They won't try the person who knocked you in the head.
Now, Wallace got more than 13% of the vote in a race that Republican Richard Nixon ended up winning. What about that third-party candidacy?
That was an important one. He also won several southern states. Mm-hmm. Vietnam is raging. There's intensifying conflict over civil rights issues like urban policy and crime. And Wallace tries to capitalize on this, and he plays to the white backlash, not just in the South, but in the North. And in some ways, he set a template that other candidates have followed, not just third-party candidates, but even some Republicans in terms of backlash politics. So that's one of those cases where the candidate loses, but some of his message continues right through today.
Why is our system set up so that it's difficult for third-party candidates to really be contenders?
Well, structurally, you have a winner-take-all system. So to get the Electoral College votes, you need to win the state. And third parties can't really compete with these massive mechanisms of the Democratic and Republican Party. So the winner-take-all system doesn't really favor third parties. And then most voters today are not genuinely independent. Even independents tend to lean to one party or the other. So there's not a lot of fans for this system.
Do you think that should or could change in this country, that it would be easier for a third party to be a real player in a presidential election?
not nationally. I think it's going to continue to be a way to just steal votes in swing states away from one of the major candidates. But at the local level, I think that's where you might see more third-party action. And you're seeing some of that. Even someone like AOC, who's received a lot of attention, benefited from the room that local politics provides to more eclectic candidates.
Do you think that Jill Stein made a difference as a third-party candidate in 2016?
Well, given the narrow victory that Trump enjoyed in states like Michigan, where she did attract votes, you can make the case that she helped open the doors to the Trump presidency.
That is Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, talking with us about third parties in America. Ross Perot, who died yesterday at the age of 89, was famously the third party candidate back in 1992, got 19% of the vote. Julian, thanks as always.
Great to be with you.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Emberwave, the revolutionary new personal thermostat that's designed to help you find thermal wellness in any situation. Emberwave can put you in control of your comfort in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, in restaurants or theaters, after a workout, at home, and more. Learn more at emberwave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. Emberwave, own your temperature.
This morning, 32-year-old Jennifer Arose told the Today Show that when she was 14 in high school, a woman befriended her, told her about a nice man who could help with her career. Jennifer says she began visiting Jeffrey Epstein with the woman. She said he would leave money for her to help with her career. But soon, she said Epstein would take her alone into massage rooms, ultimately forcing her into sex.
I just thought, like, you know, it's my fault. Like, I was, like, obligated. Like, that's just what you're supposed to do. What hurts even more so is that if I wasn't afraid to come forward sooner, then maybe he wouldn't have done it to other girls.
The Today Show says four other people confirmed Jennifer Arose told them this story a decade ago. She's now filing a lawsuit against Epstein. Jeffrey Epstein was one of the most powerful money managers in the world. His friends included former President Bill Clinton and Donald Trump. This week in New York, he pled not guilty to two counts of sex trafficking with minors. In 2008, Florida police and the FBI concluded he lured dozens of young girls into a sex ring. He was offered a deal by then U.S. Attorney Alex Acosta, pled guilty to a lesser charge of soliciting prostitutes, which the girls were not. He served 13 months in jail, out all day at his Palm Beach office. Yesterday, President Trump said he stands by Alex Acosta, now his Secretary of Labor. And Trump also said he and Epstein had a falling out. He was not a fan. Julie Brown is the reporter for the Miami Herald who broke the Florida story in the mid-2000s. Julie, do you know what this falling out was?
I do know what it was. I can't recall all the details of it, but it has to do with a property that they were fighting over in Palm Beach. I think it was a property that Epstein wanted to purchase, and Trump went in and offered the guy like triple the amount of money and kind of stole it out from underneath him.
So it was some sort of personal real estate upset. But this has brought attention to something that's sort of been on the periphery of this story for a while, a lawsuit in which both men are named. This is Jeffrey Epstein and Donald J. Trump, and a Jane Doe who made the accusation in 2016 in this lawsuit that she was raped by Donald Trump at Epstein's home. And in this lawsuit that was filed, there's another woman called Tiffany Doe who says that she was paid by Epstein to procure young women at places like bus stations and bring them to these parties, and that she witnessed this and she called it abuse. She called it both rape followed by abuse. That lawsuit, we understand, was dropped just before the election, it would appear, November 4th, 2016. Do we know any more about that lawsuit? And that lawsuit in 2016 would seem to imply that the two men at least, you know, were in a lawsuit together in 2016. I mean, do we know any more about that?
I did a lot of research on that particular claim, and I didn't get very far with it. We don't know who the woman is, you know, or where she went or where she is. And you know, I've been trying to get a hold of Lisa Bloom, the lawyer who represented her. She doesn't return my phone calls. I reached out to her on Twitter within the past couple of weeks. Mm. It's all quieted down. We don't know if it was because she was paid off. I mean, this was right around the time that President Trump was facing all this, these problems with Stormy Daniels coming out. So we don't really know. I haven't been able to find out. I hope that now that this is getting so much attention, that maybe that woman will feel, if the allegations are true, will feel more comfortable. You know, think about it. These women have all been threatened. Okay. And she was threatened. Bloom said she was threatened. So they're afraid.
What do you mean by that threatened? And by the way, let's go back to your reporting. Your really terrific reporting in the Miami Herald, in which you uncovered what the lead Palm Beach detective in that 2005 to 2008 case called a sexual pyramid scheme. You identified about 80 women molested or otherwise sexually abused by Epstein. Some accounts say that the number could be much higher. One woman told you that she recruited 70 or 80 girls. She alone recruited 70 mm-hmm. or 80 girls. At the time, what were people, these detectives working hard on this case, what did they say about this plea deal that enabled Jeffrey Epstein to plead guilty to prostitution, to soliciting women for prostitution, as opposed to the much more severe federal charge of sex trafficking? What were people who worked on this saying?
They were horrified. Joe Ricari, who's the lead detective in the case, was just devastated. He didn't stay with the police department much longer after that. He worked a little bit with the prosecutor's office on other cases, but he was just disappointed in the justice system, and he fought for these girls. There were only two people that fought for these girls, and one was Detective Joe Ricari, and the other was the former police chief, Michael Ritter. And they faced so much pressure to back off.
And that brings us to what you were talking about, the threat. When were these young women threatened? What do you mean by that?
Well, as soon as it was investigated, Alan Dershowitz, Jeffrey Epstein's friend and attorney, you know, went to the Palm Beach state attorney, Barry Krischer, with, you know, a dossier on the first woman that came forward, showing in that dossier that she came from such a troubled family. I don't remember, her parents are divorced, and look at her MySpace page, which was the precursor of Facebook back then. There are pictures of her on there. She calls herself Pimp Juice. She's drinking beer. And Ricari, the detective, to his credit, said to the prosecutor, the state prosecutor, so what, they're drinking beer? Does that mean that they weren't sexually molested? But the prosecutor, Barry Krischer, looked at this and said, you know, these women were not going to be credible witnesses. Their stories don't always match up. There was a million other reasons that he gave. And he basically said, we're going to have him settle this with a misdemeanor. He would have gotten away with just nothing at that point. So the police chief, Mike Ritter, appealed it to the FBI and told them, you've got to look at this case because it's going to go away. And that's how the whole thing got into federal jurisdiction.
Well, and it hasn't gone away. We just need to ask you, Julie Brown, again, who did such incredible reporting on this at the Miami Herald in the mid-2000s. Now the story has surfaced again. And the other name, of course, is of former President Bill Clinton. Flight logs show that he traveled on Jeffrey Epstein's private plane 20 times in the early 2000s. According to the Washington Post, described Epstein as a committed philanthropist with a keen sense of global markets. Part of Clinton's travel on Epstein's planes was to go to Africa for the Clinton Foundation and work with AIDS. Clinton has released a statement saying that he was never on any of Epstein's planes without, I believe, FBI or Clinton Foundation people in attendance. But do we know if the Clintons also socialized in the way that Donald Trump was known to have socialized with Jeffrey Epstein?
They absolutely did. And they were also very close with Epstein's partner, Ghislaine Maxwell, a British socialite.
The daughter of the late Robert Maxwell, the publisher.
Right. And she was considered his so-called madame, who was really helping him run this sex trafficking operation. She was very close to the Clintons. You know, I'm wondering how long it's going to take to pull that apart, statement that his handlers gave apart, because it seriously, from everything I've seen, it does not wash. I think there's problems with that statement that he made.
That he was only with FBI agents and foundation people.
Yeah, there's problems with that. And, you know, I always say the truth will come out. So he's now memorialized this statement that I think is going to have, it's going to have problems.
Jeffrey Epstein has pled not guilty this time around to much more severe charges of sex trafficking and with minors. But at least it has surfaced again, and he has been charged. How are people in Florida? You know, they've left the police department, some of them, but I'm wondering if you're in touch and how they're feeling.
Well, the women are just elated. They're so emotional. They have fought so hard, especially Courtney Wilde, who was one of the women that brought this lawsuit right after the plea deal in 2008. She and her lawyer, Brad Edwards, and Paul Castle, another lawyer, have really fought so hard for 11 years on this case. They really deserve a lot of credit for the courage, because they too, as part of the, you know, the side story to this is they too were bullied. I mean, Epstein sued Edwards to try to get him, you know, punish him in essence for representing these girls.
Well, and by the way, some of the women aren't doing very well, as people who were forced into sexual acts at 13 would not be. One woman told you a word can trigger something. It might be the word pure. Because Jeffrey Epstein would call, she says, would call her pure in that room she was brought into. And then I remember what he did to me in that room. I understand some of the women have died.
I know of two of the women that have died. I don't know the circumstances. I think it was a domestic violence one, the one incident. The other woman was a drug addict, and she died of an opioid overdose not that long ago, a couple years ago. She was in a very bad way. You know, Courtney Wilde was one of the women that brought the lawsuit, the crime victims lawsuit against Epstein. And she was turned into one of his recruiters. And she ended up with a drug problem, and she went to state prison in Florida, served a longer 3-year jail term in a pretty tough prison, while Jeffrey Epstein had his cozy jail cell in Palm Beach and was able to leave every day.
That's Julie Brown of the Miami Herald and the lead reporter on all the reporting on the Jeffrey Epstein case in the mid-2000s there in Florida. Julie, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thanks for having me.
The ticker tape fell as thousands in Manhattan lined a stretch of Broadway called the Canyon of Heroes to celebrate the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team's fourth World Cup win. The team was honored with keys to the city at City Hall. Here's co-captain Carly Lloyd, the third all-time leading scorer in the history of U.S. women's soccer.
I'm super, super proud of this team. You know, we were obviously here 4 years ago. It never gets old. These parades are amazing. You fans are amazing. And I'm just super proud of every single player on this team.
And NPR's Netta Ulaby was lucky to be there. Hi, Netta.
Hi.
And describe what it was like.
Oh, it was lovely. There were flurries of shredded paper wafting through the air. There was an absolutely joyful mood. It was incredibly packed, quite hot. I kind of wish history wasn't so sticky sometimes.
Yes. But how significant is this ticker tape parade for this team?
Well, you know, this is the second time, actually, that the U.S. women's national soccer team has been feted with a ticker tape parade on the streets of New York. The first time was in 2015 when that team won the World Cup. This time, it was a little different. Mm-hmm. One of the floats had a sign on it that said, parades are cool, but equal pay is cooler. Mm-hmm. As you know, there's an intense discussion happening right now about this, about the pay disputes between the discrepancy between how much the women make and how much the men make. And the U.S. women's team actually filed a gender discrimination lawsuit against the U.S. Soccer Federation back in May.
Yeah.
And there's also, of course, this ongoing spat right. with the White House.
Yes. And let's talk about that. Co-captain Megan Rapinoe. Many people a few months ago were trying to pronounce her name. Now they know this lavender-haired woman. She was on CNN last night. She told Anderson Cooper she'd happily accept an invitation to Washington from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the New York Congresswoman, or House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, or Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, but not President Trump. Now, she has kneeled during the national anthem in solidarity with Colin Kaepernick. She's an activist. And last night, she said she had this message for Trump.
I think that I would say that your message is excluding people. You're excluding me. You're excluding people that look like me. You're excluding people of color. You're excluding, you know, Americans that that maybe support you.
And when she says you're excluding me, she is gay. What has the White House said about a visit?
The White House, you know, has been going back and forth about the visit with with the U.S. women's soccer team. I think that it's all still a little bit up in the air.
Yeah, and you mentioned this lawsuit. In some cases, women, it says, are earning just 38% of pay per game that the men earn. What are people? You mentioned a sign. Were people on the streets, you know, talking about this today?
You know, people on the streets were much more in the mood to cheer than to talk about the politics that are happening right now with the women's team. But as you know, what is happening is pretty extraordinary. Governor Andrew Cuomo was there in the parade on a separate float from Bill de Blasio, and he was seen chanting equal pay," along with some people in the crowd. And this is an ongoing issue that's getting mediated. I mean, I think, as you know, the International Football Federation has allocated just $30 million in prize money for the teams that are competing in the Women's World Cup, as opposed to $440 million for those that are going to be playing.
And as Rapino says, this money that we're looking for would be also an investment in the game, you know, the coaching staff, et cetera, so broader than the players. NPR's Netta Ulubi in New York as the city feted the U.S. women's national soccer team today. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This week, we're looking at how China is gaining influence with U.S. allies in Asia. On Monday, we looked at Vietnam, where analyst Lei Hong Hiep told us China is getting around the trade war with the U.S. by shipping goods through Vietnam. He says Hanoi is finding itself in the middle of a new Cold War.
The U.S. and China are entering a new Cold War, and the two powers will expect Vietnam to take side.
Yesterday, we looked at Pakistan, where China has developed a link between its border and a Pakistani port to move goods more efficiently. And analyst Shamila Chaudhry tells us there's military cooperation as well.
Pakistani political insiders will tell us that, look, the U.S. wasn't offering us what we needed anymore, and China was knocking on our doors, so we're gladly taking their help.
Today, we're going to check in on the Philippines, where President Rodrigo Duterte has forged closer ties with China since he took office in 2016, and China has pledged to invest billions in infrastructure projects there. These closer ties are being tested now because of disputes in the South China Sea. This week, Duterte called on the U.S. military to step in and force China out of contested areas. Joining us now by Skype is Richard Haydarian, who's a research fellow at National Shangqi University in Taiwan. Richard, welcome to Here and Now.
Pleasure to be here.
Well, and Duterte came in promising closer relations with China. Has that happened?
Well, that's where the problem comes into the picture, because President Duterte and his supporters claim that as a result of his friendlier policies towards China, we have not only achieved peace or some kind of stability in terms of our territorial disputes in the South China Sea, but he also claims that there has been a bonanza, a huge deluge of Chinese economic investments into the Philippines. But I think upon closer examination, that claim is highly questionable. First of all, since President Duterte has come into power, China's reclamation of artificially created islands in the South China Sea have accelerated, and now they are more or less completed. China also accelerated its militarization of those artificial islands. And of course, in the last few months, we have seen China using its maritime militia forces to bully and pressure Filipino fishermen. And of course, the latest incident was in the Reed Bank, whereby you have a Chinese militia vessel, at least a suspected Chinese militia vessel, sinking a Filipino fishing vessel, which was just anchored in the contested areas in the South China Sea, but well within the Philippines' exclusive economic zone. And they left the 22 Filipino crewmen to essentially drown in the high seas. They would have drowned if not for a Vietnamese fisherman in the area.
Right. The Vietnamese boat came and rescued those fishermen. So what's been the reaction in the Philippines to that incident? Are people starting to question the relationship with China?
So as far as the public sentiments is concerned, it's a little bit more complicated. So when Filipino survey agencies conducted polls, it's very clear that the United States and Japan are the most preferable international partners for the Filipino people, and China is the least preferred. So China remains very, very unpopular among ordinary Filipinos. But when Filipino people were asked whether America is a reliable ally, for instance, in light of the South China Sea disputes, will the U.S. help the Philippines? That's where a large plurality of Filipinos were actually uncertain. And when they were asked, do you think that we should rather explore security cooperation with countries like China or Russia? A significant plurality of Filipinos said yes. Now, there's a second layer to this. The Pew Research Center also conducted a survey in 2017, and they asked Filipino people, do you prefer to engage with China economically, or do you prefer to confront China because of their aggressive action in the South China Sea? Back in 2015, when President Duterte was not yet in power, when you had President Benigno Aquino, who took a more confrontational stance towards China, more Filipinos wanted to stand up to China rather than economically engage China. Under President Duterte, the numbers have reversed. And this is precisely what allowed President Duterte to pivot to China without triggering a massive backlash at home or a massive drop in terms of his popularity, right?
And where is the United States in all of this? Is the U.S. trying to keep some strong influence in the Philippines, or are they just allowing China to come in and have this very close relationship?
So the United States is also scrambling. After all, the Philippines was the only Asian colony of the United States. This is based on conversation with very senior officials that for a long time, the United States took the Philippines for granted. It's kind of a second-tier ally that will always be there no matter what. And this is where President Duterte is quite revolutionary because he has transformed our relationship with U.S. from sacrosanct and sacred and very deferential into one that is increasingly just transactional. The Obama administration took a much more hard line against President Rodrigo Duterte's highly problematic human rights record, particularly his war on drugs. Once President Donald Trump came into the picture, there was some qualitative shift. One qualitative shift was a de-emphasis on human rights issues, or at least President Trump never tried to raise the human rights issues during his meetings with President Duterte or during his speeches about the Philippines. That was something that reassured President Duterte and helped to restore their relationship or at least stop the hemorrhage in bilateral relationship, which was the case under President Obama. In many ways, this was what was pushing him into the embrace of China, because China was saying, guess what? U.S. criticizes you on drug issue. I will support you on drug issue. The second issue is this. The Trump administration has expanded counterterrorism cooperation with the Philippines under Duterte because of the siege of Marawi by ISIS-affiliated elements in 2017. So ironically, counterterrorism cooperation are even better right now under Duterte with the United States than in previous administration. But that's a function of the nature of threat, shared threats that we face in Mindanao, in southern Philippines.
So what's at stake for the U.S. if China is gaining influence and the U.S. is losing influence in the Philippines?
Well, first of all, if the United States loses the Philippines to China, let's say the Philippines ends its treaty alliance with the United States or dramatically downgrades security cooperation with the United States, well, first of all, that's a huge psychological blow. And the second thing is the Philippines is very important in terms of its geographical location. Remember, Subic and Clark in the Philippines were the site of biggest American overseas naval and Air Force bases in the Cold War period. And they're now relevant again, not against the Soviet threat, but against the Chinese threat in the Western Pacific and the South China Sea. So a lot is at stake for the United States here. But this is my fundamental argument. If this is boxing, we're just round three or four. There has been no knockout yet. Because just as the United States struggles to regain the kind of comprehensive influence that it used to have over the Philippines during the past administration, the Chinese are also struggling to actually take the Philippines into their sphere of influence precisely because of public skepticism, But also the Philippine military establishment is very close to the United States. And President Duterte has struggled to convince the Philippine military to embrace China. They still see China as the primarily external security threat to the Philippines.
Do you think that if China were to just take the Spratly Islands, which are disputed, that the Philippines would just allow them to do that, or would there be a fight?
Whether Duterte wants it or not, if the Chinese engage in skirmishes or in any drastic action that essentially kicks out the Philippines from the area, I don't think any Philippine administration can survive by just sitting back. And in fact, we are seeing a preview of that with what's happening right now, whereby a lot of people are saying, hey, you have to take a tough stand. They almost killed 22 of our fishermen and drowned them. I don't think even Duterte himself wants to go down in history as the man who lost Philippine land and territory in the South China Sea.
Well, and do you think that the U.S. would come to the rescue of the Philippines if the Chinese were to try to eject the Filipino sailors from that area?
I can foresee a situation whereby the Philippine defense establishment will directly ask Pentagon for intervention. And there is a growing possibility that Pentagon will actually intervene because the Trump administration is willing to take the fight to the Chinese way more than previous American administration. I think most people are going to say, hey, see, this is what we get. You call out to China, you give them an inch, they're going to go for the whole hand. And now they want us completely out of the South China Sea. This is the scenario that could happen.
That's Richard Haydarian, who is a research fellow at National Shangqi University in Taiwan and author of the book, The Rise of Duterte, A Populist Revolt Against Elite Democracy. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And tomorrow we'll wrap up our series with a look at Indonesia. You can find all of our stories at hereandnow.org. What a head talking, we not in there.
That's 27-year-old rapper Tiny Jag, who was scheduled to perform at the Afrofuture Musical Festival in Detroit in August. Then she found out about the price structure for tickets. Whites would be asked to pay twice as much as people of color, POCs. So she pulled out in protest. Let's find out more. Jag joins us now from Detroit. Hi.
Thank you so much for having me today.
This is fascinating. The festival backers say the ticketing is about calling attention to inequity. But when you found out about it, what did you think? How'd you take that in?
Well, I was first shocked because this was the first I was hearing about it, and it was from a non-POC friend of mine. And I was immediately upset.
Well, let's explain. You are mixed race. And correct. I understand that some of the songs you perform come from your first project. It's called Polly, and that was your grandma's name, and she was white. I'm imagining you're thinking, would my grandmother pay $20 instead of $10? Or those were the early bird
exactly.
tickets, or the price is going to go up to $20 for people of color, $40 for whites.
I don't think I was wondering if they would be able to pay it, but just the message that it sent, I didn't know this was the direction that we were headed. So it was enlightening for me as well.
We reached out to the organizers of the Afrofuture Musical Festival. We haven't heard back, but they have said on the Eventbrite website that this structure was built to ensure that more marginalized communities, people of color, are provided with an equitable chance at enjoying events in their own community. We know that there are huge racial disparities in income and wealth, and a lot of it fixed generations ago in things like racial gerrymandering, people not getting loans, decades of inequity leading to this huge gap. Have you had any friends say to you, well, what's wrong with maybe correcting that in a ticket price, but at the very least drawing attention to it?
Oh, absolutely. I've had maybe not friends, to be mm-hmm. honest with you, but quite a bit of backlash, especially from the local Black music and art community here in Detroit. And just coming from a sense of maybe I'm identifying more with one part of myself or even belittling another part of myself, the portion of me that is Black, it's just not the truth. I didn't have to be anything except whatever my soul looks like. And I would have had an issue with that regardless, because it's not part of my views. I don't see the world that way.
Tell us more about that. How does that feel to you, the separate ticket prices?
Just in a way that we would have to compromise our integrity or alienate another race in order to improve, as you said, fixed and institutionalized systemic disparities. So Never have I sat down with anyone who put in our blueprint for what we're going to do from here an alienation of anyone else. That's never been a part of it. I know that's not our only option. That's not a thing.
I'm wondering if it would feel differently if it was somehow, well, like a project that was undertaken by Nigerian chef Tunde Wey in New Orleans. His was both a research project and kind of an art installation. He had a food shack. He had a price of $12 for a meal for people of color. He gave whites the option of paying that $12 or paying $30. As he said, the 2.5-time increase for whites would reflect the income disparity between whites and African Americans in New Orleans. And Tulane University helped him design this experiment, and people had to fill out a survey, and conversations got started about inequities. If the whites chose to pay more, that money was redistributed to the African Americans or Asians who signed up for it. So it was people knowing that they were a part of allowing themselves to feel a social experiment. Would that have been different?
I think the only thing that makes it different for me there would be, yes, the communication that was there, as well as them having the option to pay more if that's what they so please. Then we were explaining that the only reason that we're asking for that donation is to reflect the disparity. Sure, I would have felt differently.
You mentioned that you heard from many in the Black community. You heard from white supremacists as well. Were they thinking that you were somehow siding with them and rejecting this charging whites more? I mean, what'd you hear from them?
To be honest with you, the few that I've seen, they're definitely not thinking that I'm siding with them, but it's just a very blanketed type of like you go girl type thing. But when you go to the page, you can see what type of person they are.
Well, the festival has withdrawn the split ticket structure. Might you play there now that that's happened?
No, because the organization made it very clear that the only reason that it was changed wasn't because of any school of thought modification or anything like that. It was only because of the threats that they began to receive. So I can't support the school of thought where the ticket structure is actually still figuratively supported, but is just technically changed to make sure that no one was harmed.
27-year-old rapper Tiny Jag thrust into a controversy in Detroit there, scheduled to perform at the Afrofuture Musical Festival until she found out that they were going to charge more for whites than blacks to ensure that, as they said, marginalized people of color were able to attend the concert. And she's saying there's a better way to do that. Tiny Jag, thank you so much for speaking with us about it.
Robin, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it. I'm happy to share the awareness when I can.
And we want to hear your thoughts out there on different ticket prices to underscore inequity. Let us know, hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.